Welcome to Picnic Climbers, a podcast for those who love getting outside,
going on epic adventures,
or chill ones,
and don't take themselves too seriously. Join us, Nate and Mo,
as we share our escapades into the great outdoors.
And don't forget the beer, eh?
All right then, Picnic Climbers, we have got a treat for you today. We are doing our very first interview. Feeling very accomplished here. So it is my privilege to introduce our good friend, Stephen Miller. You right, Steve?
Hello there. Yeah, I'm doing good.
Good, good. So Steve, Steve is fun-loving, good-looking, clever-sounding.
And no longer single.
And no longer single.
And I have a buttery, buttery English voice.
He's got a master's in chemistry. He has a commercial pilot's license. However, his recent jobs include working in a vegetable processing plant and in a Ford dealership. Oh. Is that about right, Steve?
Yeah, that kind of sums it up, really. Yeah, I did just finish becoming a commercial pilot just as the world went crazy and shut down. So that was an absolutely brilliant time.
So unfortunate for you, mate. I'm very sorry.
That's all right. I used to rock climb before the world ended as well, so I guess that's why you want me on here.
Yeah, so Steve, tell us your journey into outdoor adventures. Tell us some of the sports you like to do and tell us why you are a picnic climber.
Yeah, my parents liked to take the family on walks and hikes and go camping when we were younger, although I never really liked camping with my parents too much because we had a really horrible, awkward tent. Oh. Which was like a million pieces to put up. And also, living in the UK, it rains every single day. Mm.
Awful.
So camping is just like, you can't plan for it. You just have to go, all right, this weekend, it looks good, we're going.
Yeah, but you have to pick it so many months in advance as well, don't you? Otherwise, all the decent camping spots get booked up.
Yeah, and wild camping is somewhat, it's in England, it's somewhat frowned upon. In Scotland, it's fine. So I've had some good wild camping experiences in Scotland and funny stories related to that. in England, it's sort of wild camping is do it when you can't, you know, if you're not, don't do it by the side of the road, just do it when you're above like 500 feet or something on terrain and no one's going to stop you, but you can't just pitch up in a field and set up a tent.
No.
As a friend of mine found out when he decided to camp out near the bottom of some of the climbs in the Peak District. Oof. And then at 4 a.m, one of the rangers comes around and turfs him and his friends away.
I'm surprised he made it to 4 a.m.
I know, maybe it was 2 a.m. I don't know. It was like early in the morning and they just kind of kicked them all off. But yeah, so my parents, we would go out just for walks across some of the hillier terrain. There are some hills in the UK, but not that many, really. But yeah, so we'd do that. But I never really... And I went rock climbing indoors once in my teenage years and enjoyed it, went bouldering as well, but never really kind of got into it until university, when a course mate of mine was going to the bouldering room. And I went, oh, bouldering, that sounds fun. I've been going to the gym for a bit and was kind of bored of just being in a gym. And so then decided, you know what, I'm going to go and do something else. Went kind of bouldering inside, bought some climbing shoes, bought some other bits and pieces, and kind of got into doing a bit of indoor bouldering at uni because it was super cheap to get membership. Even though the bouldering wall was tiny, it was still, there was actually some good routes there. So they went from the very easiest to ridiculous, impossible dinos that you have to be 6'7" and have springs for legs to be able to do. And then some friends of mine were into... So the course mate of mine who introduced me, but also someone I eventually lived with at uni, he has a mountain leader kind of qualification and did lots of climbing with scouts and various other groups, and also was heavily involved with the university mountaineering club, which I didn't actually get involved with, which is one of my biggest regrets, because I thought they'd just be walking up the hills. I didn't realize they'd actually be like rock climbing, which I probably would have found a bit more interesting. Anyway, so he was involved with them and we started going climbing indoors. We did a couple of trips to the nearby climbing wall, which in Southampton was like an hour and a half away by public transport.
Yeah, well, Southampton, I mean, so you're right on the south coast of the UK there, aren't you? And like, yes. the UK has hills. There are none of those hills are in the south coast.
No, none of them are. Like, Southampton is where you go to learn to sail, and where you learn to be posh, and where you learn to drink gin out in the sun on the Isle of Wight, going... Blah, blah, blah.
Sounds great. Kind of
I mean...
I would like to sail and be posh.
Yeah, so I didn't actually learn to sail, which was ridiculous. I probably should have done. But I actually have learned to sail since then, but... not when I was living next to a
you
load
just
of
need
water.
To work out the correct order of things. Like, learn to sail when you're in the sailing destination. Learn to climb when you live near places to climb.
Exactly. I've just done it all the wrong way. Like, I learned to sail in Birmingham where on a reservoir because there's no like lakes near here or anything. So I'm just like
you, my friend, have some terrible timing, I think.
Yeah. Yeah. So, you know, I like doing lots of outdoor sports and things. But yeah, so got involved with kind of climbing that way, and eventually we did some outdoor climbing in Wales, in Snowdonia, which is where, just going to put this out, the British Mount Everest Expedition 1953 actually trained in Snowdonia. Because, you know, Everest is a mountain, Snowdon, that we could call it a mountain if we wanted to. Mm. Yeah, let's train there, why not? Yeah, so did some stuff there. There's like, it's like some of the only multi-pitch that you can actually find in the UK. But yeah, so did some, just did a couple of like single pitch climbing out there and kind of just got a feel into it that way.
Sweet, cool. So why, what makes you a picnic climber, Steve?
What makes me a picnic climber is that I love the idea of going outside and having a good day involving minimal pain and minimal misery and minimal injury. So I've been with like far too many climbers whose days consist of starting a day, falling off a route, injuring their ankles, going no, I can still do this, don't take off my shoe, I can still climb, don't undo it, and then like having to hobble down for like a mile from the crag back to the car, or me carry them on my shoulders, which has happened. Whereas I like to go climb a couple of routes, which I think I can probably do, relax out in the sun or rain, as I do.
That's more realistic, isn't it? Yeah.
But we'll like, yeah. So just a little aside. One time I went on a little climbing trip to the Peak District, which. The name may make you think that there are lots of hills there. It is not that peaky. It is more like just rolling hills.
It's very strange, but isn't it?
We don't really know how to name things over here. Like,
it's true. When I first went to the Peak District, I was like, where are the peaks? It's pretty much a shelf. Like, there's two layers of land, and you climb up the shelf. That's the only way I can think to describe it.
It's a large flat top.
It's a large flat top, and then... So you're either on the top of the large flat top or you're at the bottom. That's it. There are no peaks.
At all. There's no like ultra prominent peak, which you might think to call like a mountain there. It's just like, yeah.
Maybe they named it on a cloudy day, which is probably most of the days. And so they're like, I can't see where this goes, but it probably ends in a peak.
It could do.
We don't know.
I can just imagine it back in like the 1700s or something, and they'd just be like, Horace, what do you think of this place? And I'd be like, yeah, it's not flat like Oxfordshire where I'm from. It's sort of a bit more hilly than that, and yes, the Peak District sounds like a good name.
I love it. Sounds about right.
Yeah.
Fantastic. So, anyway, Steve, it's good to have you on.
It's good to be on.
Brilliant. Glad to hear it. Our first guest, mate. You should feel honoured.
Oh, I do feel a huge amount of honour and privilege to be on an illustrious podcast such as this.
Mm. Mate, we have a solid 50 listeners.
Hello, 50 listeners.
Yeah. We'll have 100 after this. I know it.
Or 25.
We'll see. Anyway, so our topic for today, we are going to be talking about the differences in the outdoor culture, and particularly the climbing culture in the UK versus North America, because it really surprised us when I've done most of my outdoor climbing in Canada. Monica had exclusively climbed in Canada. When we came over to the UK a few years ago...
New Zealand. I feel like I've done most of my climbing in New Zealand.
Okay.
Anyway.
When we came over to the UK, it really surprised us how different it was. And so we thought that would be an interesting thing to talk about. Most of our listeners are Canadian. And so I thought we would start, Monica, I'll pass it over to you. What does a day of climbing look like in Canada? Talk to us about the surroundings, talk to us about the views, talk to us about the nature of the climbs.
Sure. But first of all, I'm just going to preface this that I have never climbed or been any further east than Saskatchewan. And Saskatchewan has nothing to climb. So the only climbing I've done in Canada has been in BC. So when we say Canada, I mostly mean the west coast of BC, particularly Squamish and surrounding area. So that's the
Is there purpose. Anywhere else that's worth climbing?
Well, that is up for debate.
I'm joking.
That's not the topic.
I'm absolutely joking on that one.
I'm sure that there is. But yeah, we're talking about Squamish mainly. So you go to Squamish, you drive up the beautiful Sea to Sky Highway, which is pretty much dramatic mountain cliffs with actual peaks on one side of you, and then the winding ocean with lots of islands off the coast of it, and so just beautiful hills, glistening sea, stunning mountains, often snow-capped, and it's this gorgeous drive, nice and windy, along the coast until you arrive in this little mountain village called Squamish, which you lived in, so you could probably... talk a lot about Squamish, but yeah, so you get there and there's lots of different crags, there's lots of different places that you can go. The big looming one is called the Chief, which we have done, and it's beautiful and very striking, very dark. Is it granite?
Yep.
Yes.
Yep. It's very tall.
Yeah, very tall. Definitely a lot of multi-pitch going on. So you rock up to one of the many car parks. There's some climbing where you can pretty much see the climbs from the car park and just hop right on over, and then there's some that have like a forested walk to get to them that you need to carry your gear to. But pretty much anywhere you go, you're going to have stunning views of the nearby mountain ranges that are often snow-capped. You're going to be walking through forest, which is a very famous kind of forest that is rare, and it is called, I forget, geography teacher. It's like the lush coast forest.
The rainforest?
Yeah, I guess it's just the temperate rainforest. Okay. But I thought it had a fancy name.
Maybe it is.
Okay, well, we'll fact check that, get back to you. But anyway, it's lush and gorgeous and tons of evergreen trees and beautiful undergrowth and et cetera, et cetera. And so you just have beautiful views. The likelihood of nice weather in the summer is a lot higher in Vancouver and Squamish and surrounding areas than it is maybe in the UK. Is that kind of what you wanted me to do? Set the scene? Anything else?
Yeah,
any other details?
So that's kind of the views and the surroundings. Right. Talk to us about the climbs themselves. What do the climbs look like?
Okay, so you've got a lot of options whether you want a single pitch or multi-pitch. There's a lot of tall stuff around, but a lot of people just like to single pitch for the day. It's much more of a picnic climber type thing to do. You just rock up, you set up a climb, you do a climb, you come down, you do another climb, you come down. So they're pretty tall compared to here, I would say. What's the average? Like 20 to 30 feet-ish?
Oh, no, I'd say more like 20 meters.
That's what I meant, probably. 20 to 30 meters. So a good long way. You're the standard, I would say, is a 60-meter rope. And some people have longer. And you go and you take the rope up. And you don't need a lot of gear because mostly things are bolted. Some of the multi-pitch stuff isn't, but that's easily avoided if you only have kind of quick draws and a rope and you want to go. You can have a really great day outdoors because everything's bolted. There's chains at the top, so once you get to the top, you literally just clip in and then rappel down, or you can set up a top rope anchor if the next person wants to top rope climb. Yeah, so it's really straightforward. It's really safe. The bolts are often quite close together, so if you are not super confident leading, I mean, it's it's not, you're never going to have massive falls. And once you get to the top, you don't really have to worry too much about having a secure anchor because it's already there. And you come down and you grab your gear and you're good to go. So yeah, it's kind of nice and quick if you want to do lots of climbs, straightforward for that.
Yeah, you can go through a lot of climbs very quickly.
Yeah, you can. And everything, there's so many in kind of one area. And so you kind of pick the day that it is, if you want a shady area, if you want a sunny area, if you want a busy area, if you want to hike in, if you want to pull up somewhere and have a big picnic in the car park. There's a little lake you can swim in and there's climbs around that. Mm. So yeah, you've just got tons of choices.
Very cool. Awesome. Thank you. Steve, how does that compare to the UK?
I mean, it sounds pretty much exactly the same, really. I think the road going through the mountains with the sea on one side, I can just picture that as I drive up the motorway, up the highway.
Surrounded by lorries.
Surrounded by lorries. No, the...
Big trucks for our Canadian listeners.
No, so climbing over here is a... It's like a battle against nature. I think that's the best way to put it. Like, if you happen to live in a city called Sheffield, you are about 15 to 30 minutes, depending on where you live in the city, away from 4 miles of gritstone climbing. And it's something called, it's a place called Stanage Edge in the Peak District. And it is about, most of the climbs, I'd say about 15 meters, I reckon 10 to 15. So I've definitely been there and climbed on a 30 meter rope and got away with it for a few of the climbs.
It's really short though for the most part. Like,
that's because it's a shelf. Yeah. You're literally just getting on top of a shelf over and over in different ways.
Yeah.
And it's sort of set in this kind of really idyllic British countryside, rolling hills all around. But unfortunately, there's one part of the national park that it's in, which is zoned not to be a national park. And it's right in the middle. And you can see it from every part on this kind of on this shelf, which is this big old cement factory. It's just this huge eyesore right in the middle. So instead of having like the mountains on one side and the sea on the other, we have like a kind of a mossy covered landscape with sheep roaming on it on one side. And then a cement factory on the other side. That's kind of like, to set the scene. Yep.
It's lovely. And what about the weather?
The weather is unpredictable at best. Like, if you're planning something more than a few days in advance, you are going to need to take wet weather gear and dry weather gear. If you're going in summer, like, if you're planning a trip a month in advance, it could be anywhere between 30 degrees and clear skies, probably with a bit of wind, or 10 degrees of raining and cold. Those that, like, so if you're going for a trip and you're planning a long time in advance, like, you've got to go for any of those. Like, you could turn up at the crag and it could be raining, and like I did with a friend once, we actually went to a theme park for the day in our waterproofs. We had like 2-for-1 vouchers. We've been camping. And we're just like, we're not going to go climbing today. There's just no chance. So we had like 2-for-1 vouchers from breakfast bars and went to the theme park. And it was great. We went on like the front row of every single ride because no one was there because it was raining.
That's really funny.
But back to climbing.
I would say the one, you say it's unpredictable. I would say the one thing that is predictable about Stanage is the wind.
Yeah.
Because of where it is kind of on the shelf, I find that you just get like this really strong wind blowing into the cliff, and it's just always there. So even if it's like a nice warm day elsewhere, you get to the cliff and it's just windy and kind of cold all the time.
Yeah. That is absolutely correct. Like, you can be, I think Stanage is like that. There's another place which is, so from Birmingham where we are, it's probably about similar time to get there. It's about an hour and a half drive is the Roaches, which is, it's kind of about, there's two separate cliffs of about 15 meters. So you can climb up to the top one, and then there's also someone's carved like steps into the rock face. There is actually like a little staircase to get up. Then there's the kind of a next, another layer of 15 meters above that with some pretty good routes on. And with that one, there's some wooded areas at the bottom, so it's a bit more sheltered. Like, you could go there, hammock out for the night on a good kind of warm night, and then go climbing the next day, as long as you don't get caught by the rangers. Yeah, because it is just next to the road as well, so it's not that far, too far away.
Yeah.
But yeah, once you get to the top, you will always need to climb up with a belay jacket, because as soon as you get to the top, like, you can be sweating all your way up, but as soon as you top out, you get on top, you build your anchor, the wind is just going to be kicking you, and you're not going to be able to hear anything. That, you know, it's like yelling instructions to the other people. It doesn't make a difference. Like, you can't hear them.
No, it's crazy.
You gotta have some sort of like rope tugging code or something.
Yeah, okay.
Three flicks means I'm ready to come down.
I actually fell off on seconding and fell off a route, and my belay at the top had no idea. He couldn't see me over the edge and just had no idea that I'd fallen off until someone else went up the descent route to tell him at the top that I'd fallen and wasn't climbing anymore, and then he lowered me down.
That's crazy.
And oh my goodness. It was on a big overhang.
And you're just dangling helplessly. You couldn't do anything.
I was just dangling. It was good, like, falling practice. Apart from that, I was just swinging.
Yeah.
It's testament that he built a good anchor, I can tell you that.
Yeah, absolutely. So, okay, so Steve, tell us a little bit about the climbs. Kind of maybe a little bit more about the rock. You mentioned gritstone, but what's the rock like, and what is the climbing actually like, particularly the protection?
So the rock is... you're the geologist. I don't know what a gritstone is. Sedimentary.
Well done. Yes.
it's really sandpapery. Mm. Where it's fresh. Lots, like, some of the roots are quite polished, so it's actually quite smooth, and all the bits that you really need good grip on, especially on some of the boulders where they've been climbed since like the 50s every day, and they are just like the grade is sort of like a V1. And it is impossible just because it's so polished. These shoes just don't grip. But anyway, back to the traditional climbing. So we here in the UK don't believe in bolting routes. We think well, there are some places. Okay, so like in Malham Cove in Yorkshire, it's a limestone kind of big cove made in the Ice Ages or something. Mm-hmm. And there are lots of bolted routes on there. I think probably because it's limestone, I think it's just not good for
you just couldn't protect climbing. You just couldn't protect it using trad. And I mean, Malham Cove has got the UK's hardest climbs. I think the UK's only 9A is in Malham Cove.
What is that?
15A.
Yeah.
The UK's only 15A is in this place, Malham Cove. Yeah, it's limestone. But there's very few people climb there because it is so challenging, of course.
9A could be a 514.
Oh, 514, okay.
I've got a handy conversion chart in front of me. So when I talk about the impossible British grading, which is very hilarious.
We'll get there. But yeah, so talk about the protection on gritstone.
Protection?
Yeah.
Don't fall.
Protection is, don't fall. Your protection is your climbing shoes. Fall.
Be good at climbing.
It's like your aid climbing because you're using chalk. That's the sort of thing. So the rock is quite weathered and it's got lots of cracks and fissures running through it. And so the trad gear which is used is where you'd have some sort of camming device, which you can pull handles, put it into a crack, and it'll splay outwards and then can't be removed because it would have to pretty much break the rock apart for it to fall out. And there's various different, that's kind of an active piece of gear which you can manipulate to make it smaller. Whereas passive protection is where you're pretty much just putting a metal lump into a crack in a rock. You're kind of securing it by moving it and just tugging on it and going, yeah, that's probably gonna hold. it's a bit more safe than that, but that's kind of the general thing. And then you clip your rope through that and you don't fall on it. I mean, you can fall on it. It should take you. The thing is, it just makes you very wary about taking a lead fall. I've taken maybe one or two lead falls outside, because you got to trust the fact that what you've put in is going to catch you.
But I also feel like for people who've climbed in Squamish with these beautiful splitter cracks or corners that just go all the way up and are super easy to just, oh, place gear whenever you feel like it, it's not like that.
No, no.
The like, thing... you might put one or two pieces in. And I mean, granted, it's only 15 meters, but...
Yeah, when I think of gritstone, the things that comes to mind to me is so I'm used to climbing, or when I climbed cracks, when I first started trad climbing, a lot the cracks were all vertical. And so, yeah, you'd be following this vertical crack system for 20 meters or whatever. But in Stanage, the cracks are horizontal rather than vertical. And what you're doing is you're kind of trying to get up to the next horizontal crack so you can put in a cam in the horizontal crack, and then you might have like 6 to 10 foot or like even like 20 foot of just blank slab before you get to the next crack, and then you put another camp like device in. And so what you have to, everyone will double up their protection in these horizontal cracks, so it's like as if you know, yes, you've got two pieces of protection, but they're both in at the same spot, so if, you know, like some of your falls can end up being absolutely huge. Like you're whipping a long way on this cam device that you've put in horizontally. Which, if you read it, like Freedom of the Hills, it suggests don't put them in horizontally because they're not as good.
No,
it just blows my mind. I was gonna find it before this, and I'm sorry that I didn't know. But I remember reading the Eastern Grit guidebook, and there's one climb in there that it says something along the lines of sketchy pro normally done as a bold boulder as a bold solo. Yeah. And this is like a 30 foot climb, and it's not easy either. It's a blank wall with nothing to protect it.
Well, isn't that one of the differences though? Like a lot of people, when you go there, probably climb things that they know they can do.
Yeah.
Like falling, you're kind of expected not
don't.
To fall.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's just like, and pieces are just in case. But whereas, yeah, sport climbing in Canada, you want to push grades, you want to challenge yourself and try things that are harder than maybe you can do on the first try and take whipper after whipper and grow and get better. That's just not the
not
thought.
The dumb thing.
No, no, not the...
Like, if you're climbing indoors at a gym, that would be where you practice your just pushing your grades as hard as you can, and you're just kind of get beyond so that when you go outside, you climb, or hopefully climbing something that is so far in your comfort range that you should have no problem.
Yeah.
But then you're not like just quickly clipping in, you're faffing about, because every time you're putting gear in, if you've got an active bit of protection like a cam, you can probably set it up in, I know some people get really good at them and can put them in and get them in 10, 15 seconds. So you've got to be in a nice safe position or in a bold position and just be quick and get your gear in, which you're also trusting your life with. So, you know, you're not trying to speed through it. But then sometimes when you're new, you have to spend a lot of time on the ground. I know I did, practicing placing gear before I can even climb. And like eyeing up, is that crack going to be a, you know, what size hex or what size nuts am I going to be putting in that to kind of, you know, stop me from falling too far, or finding a nice shelf on your climb where you can put some gear in, take a quick breather, and then continue on with an absolutely hard bit. Possibly getting to the point. So I've been like, being run out is something you just have to be used to.
Yeah.
I've been climbing and on, I don't know, probably been 15, 20 foot off the ground, but knowing that the last bit of gear, just because of where I was climbing and that I had to do a bit of a traverse to keep the route going, if I'd have fallen, I'd have swung, I was probably more than 20 foot away from my last bit of gear that I had put in. And you're just like, if I fall, I'm decking out. Like,
yeah.
But you just gotta not think about it.
No, you don't. You just
sweaty.
Yeah, you just don't think about it, and you just go. And so, yeah, so that's so because of this, because this is the standard practice. I mean, the UK has developed its own very strange grading system. It took us ages to get our heads around it. Steve,
have we got our heads around
probably
it?
Probably not.
I'm not
always
sure
get them,
I have.
I always get them the wrong way around.
Very serious, very difficult.
Severe.
Oh, serious.
Very severe, hard, very severe. severe, like hard severe. Like,
okay, start at the beginning.
Yeah, well, no, I'm gonna give it over to Steve. So can you please explain to us, firstly, what is the purpose of this grading system? Because it doesn't, the letters doesn't necessarily indicate difficulty. What do the letters indicate?
The letters indicate how brave you are. Like,
oh, dear.
There are two grading systems. Well, there are kind of two grading ranges. One which is for a well-protected route, and one which is for bold routes. It's like, if there's lots of gear there, then the grade you're going to get is going to be easier. Between the technical, so each kind of adjectival, is that a word? I don't know. Each descriptive name for a grade has a range of technical grades with inside it. So, for example, a hard, very severe grade, so HVS, can range from a 4C to a 5B.
Do you have that in the Yosemite system?
So that's a 5.8 to a 5.10.
Yeah.
Okay. Which is a massive range.
Yeah.
Like, beginner is 5.8, whereas 5.10 is kind of the starting point of the next level.
So you think, so HVS spans that whole thing. So if you're climbing an HVS 4A, did you say 4A?
Yeah, 4C.
Sorry.
So 5.8.
Yeah, 5A. So an HVS 4C.
Yeah.
Then that, so would that be bold or safe?
So that would be bold. That would be, there's less gear, but it's an easier route.
Okay. And then if it's an HVS 5A.
Yeah. That would be, it's harder technically to climb. There's probably more, there's going to be two more technical moves in there, but it's safer mentally because there's more gear going up.
It's a crazy system, isn't it?
We have to look up at every single grade in the back of the guidebook to figure out if it's safe or bold or hard or and every time.
Yeah. And so routes will have, there'll be like a VS, so very severe, and then it will have a technical grade with it as well. So you get a feel for, is this going to be like a nice walk in the park, or am I going to be run out a lot doing this?
Mm. Yeah.
And even the ones where they're well protected, you're still going to be a bit kind of, for me anyway, because I'm not, unfortunately, I don't get to go out as much as I would like. And so I haven't mastered the whole bravery part yet. I'm still kind of like, this doesn't feel very safe.
No.
Well, it's not.
No.
Yeah,
it's not.
I'm glad that you have that accurate feeling.
Yeah.
Yeah, so it's a very interesting one, isn't it? And because it goes on beyond, so we've only scratched, like, we've really talked about the bottom of the grading system, isn't it?
So the grading system actually kind of comes from scrambling routes. So you have grades 1 to 3 scramble. So grade 1 is quite an easy. You're going to be climbing over boulders, but nothing too technical. Grade 2, it's going to be a bit harder. Grade 3 scrambling is the same as a moderate climb, where you could be pitching parts of your scramble. So you could have something, you know, so you're climbing over rocks which are maybe too big to just climb over. You might need to set up some sort of gear and protection to climb over something in a scramble. And then, and so the first one that they came up with was probably, as I imagine, was two like Victorian chaps just kind of talking to each other and would be like, oh yes, that was rather moderate, that climb. Moderate seems like a good name for it.
And that became an M.
And then that became mod, an M. Yeah. And then like they'd have a go at something else. But like, well, that was difficult, wasn't it? Wasn't it, Jenkins? Yeah, it's very difficult. And they kind of started the names way too, like, the names sound much worse. Because the difficult is, if you are able to climb, like, in the Yosemite, we're talking, like, that's a 5.2 to a 5.3.
Yeah.
So, sport grade. Yeah.
Sport grade, we're talking, like, 2 to 3A, maybe. Which, and that's called difficult. So, like, they just seem to run out of words. Because they went, well, difficult. Well, next one. Well, that was very difficult. After that, like, well, that was hard, very difficult. and then they get into even more interesting things where they get like, well, that was severe, don't you think? That was rather severe. And then hard, severe, then very severe, then hard, very severe. HVS. HVS is also like is I mean it's hard for HVS. I was about to say it's very difficult, but I've already called something
not,
very difficult.
It's not difficult.
So I can't go back down. Like but hard very severe is
challenging.
I know is very challenging. I know people who have like some friend for an amateur climber, that's kind of getting towards
or a picnic
the
climber.
Top. Or even a picnic climber. Like even people who aren't picnic climbers, I've been going with people who aren't picnic climbers and hard very severe. If you can do a hard very severe, you are doing all right. And then they kind of ran out of names after that. So the next one is extremely severe. So that's just, and then after that they just went E1, E2, E3, E4, E5, all the way up to E11. And an E11 is ridiculous.
Aren't you just soloing very hard climbs at that point?
It's basically high ball bouldering at that point, isn't it?
Yeah.
There are movies of, I think lots of these are kind of up in Scotland on big kind of basalt columns out to sea. So that's the first problem is you're climbing something pretty much impossible. And you can watch videos of, hi, Rowan.
Making himself known.
He is making himself
known. I want to talk.
In some ways, he was really the first guest on this podcast. It's like picnic climbing with Nate and Mo. And Rowan. But yeah, so there's videos of climbers like Dave McLeod, who's a very famous Scottish climber, and he will be saying there's only a few months you can climb a particular climb because most of the time the start is underwater or it's just too wet, and you can only climb at certain times of the day because of the tides, and they're just going to be kind of ridiculous things that you watch and you're just going, how is he even... What's he even holding on to at that point? Like,
yeah, it's crazy, isn't it?
Yeah. And using things like micro wires for protection, which just, if anything's got the name micro and wire, and it's supposed to save your life, you're like, are you sure? Like,
yeah.
Are you sure?
I know. How you get up that confidence, I guess it's just from a lifetime of doing it and getting used to it.
Yeah, and like lots of trad climbers will peak out their ability. I mean, some of them are young, but many of them are sort of late 30s to 40s, just because I think it takes that long to build up sort of the maybe mental endurance or something. I don't know.
Yeah, well, that's it, isn't it? You get limited more by how bold you are, or how brave you are, rather than your actual climbing ability. And I think that's the biggest difference to the North American culture, is that in North America they make it safe so that it's more people can do it and you can really actually push your ability rather than just being afraid of falling. And then there's just having that danger of you know, trying something because you think you're brave enough for it, but then falling and decking and actually seriously hurting yourself.
Yeah, I know a climber friend of mine, she fell off an HVS and broke her back.
Oh.
Not so much that she became paralyzed, but she kind of just, I think, broke some vertebrae or something.
Oh, yikes.
I mean, it doesn't matter if you're not paralyzed, that's still pretty traumatic.
I mean, it's still pretty intense, but I'm just saying she's since then started climbing again.
Yeah. Good on
her. As you do.
Ago. And it's like, you know, but doesn't really climb anything that... Well,
yeah.
When I last was climbing with her, she wasn't climbing anything that challenging.
Yeah. I've just I think this epitomizes the UK climbing culture very, very well. This is a guy named Steve McClure, who is a professional climber in the UK. He's pioneered some of the hardest climbs in the UK, including the 9A+. So we're looking at 514/15 at that point. And his quote on this one blog post that I found was, until recently, sport climbing was generally regarded as downright cheating in Britain.
Yes.
Which is like, oh my goodness. And his, like, the arguments against bolting here that he shares, just rock damage, destroying futuristic bold lines, overcrowding the crags, and this is my favourite, damage to our strong tradition.
No, I'd say I reckon that is a part of the kind of the British mountaineering psyche, which is you turn up, you don't change anything that's out there, you leave it exactly as it is. You know, so you take back all your trash, you wouldn't you know, you leave footprints, and as the classic thing goes, you know, take only pictures and leave only footprints or whatever.
Don't leave bolts is what you're saying.
Don't leave bolts.
Don't drill into the rock. It's
you
cheating.
Silly North Americans.
He goes on in this and he suggests, you know, so many people enjoy the thrill of sport climbing, and in many cases, if it were not for the bolts, the routes themselves would never have been climbed. Which is like, okay, yeah, fair enough. So he's stating that yes, maybe bolts are good because they allow people to climb harder and harder things. However, the end of that sentence, in brackets, he includes the word yet, suggesting that really it's only a matter of time until all the hard sport routes get climbed either soloed or with one random piece of protection somewhere that doesn't really do a lot.
Yikes. So pretty much soloed.
Yeah.
When you watch videos of hard kind of sport climbs, I there's just no, you know, Adam Ondra kind of like climbing something. I'm just like, I don't think he could take the weight of, you know, of having a rack which would weigh as much as him and climb it. And that's the other thing, which is like, as well as climbing, you've also got to lug up maybe 5 to 10 kilos of metalwork.
Yeah.
Unless you've already done the route and you know which pieces of gear. So some people, when they're doing a route, if you're doing a hard route, you will have studied it. So you'll have learnt the route. You'll know exactly where the gear is. You'll probably top rope it. Well, I don't know. I'm probably speaking beyond my knowledge here.
That's okay.
If I was going to do something really challenging, I would probably top rope it a few times, practice climbing it, get the moves in, and then know exactly which bits of gear I need to take as well. So that when I approach it, I turn up with 5 pieces of gear. I go, all right, this one's here, this one's next, you know, next 10 feet up or whatever, and getting that in that way. Because you don't want to be lugging an entire trad rack around.
No, I think you're certainly not alone with that idea. I think, you know, certainly I know, like, people going for their first E1 or something like that, they'll do something very similar to that, won't they? Top rope it, get really confident on it, and then lead it, because like, leading it is basically soloing it.
Which is why I think another difference that we didn't really talk about is just how long it takes. Like, I think that, well, I mentioned it maybe briefly, that you could do tons of climbs in a day, where I think is in the UK, like, if we do 3 or 4 climbs, then good for us.
Because I think it's a mental strain, isn't it? You get to lunchtime, you've done a couple of climbs, I'm still alive, I might leave it there for the day.
But also just the systems, right? Like, you have to sort out your rack every time, and you're most likely belaying, like doing a top-down belay and setting up an anchor. And I mean, you didn't mention it, don't really matter, but when you get to the top, sometimes there's nothing really obvious to build an anchor on.
Oh, yeah, you're always on a gear anchor.
So you're always on a gear anchor, but also there might be a boulder like a few meters away, and that's the only thing you've got to build an anchor with. So you got meters worth of webbing that you need to bring up, because who knows what will be available. So that can take 10-15 minutes before your second is even ready to come up, and then they're taking all the pieces. So it's just an effort.
You got to scare the sheep away from your anchor.
You do. You gotta save the
snacks,
don't
scare the
man.
Sheep away. Picnic. They're an important part of the anchor at the top.
That's true. I'm just gonna
sling around a sheep.
I'm just gonna sling a sheep.
I've definitely used tree as protection on a climb. Like, you can throw a sling around a tree, and the tree's hanging on. It's not gonna fall off.
Trees are a great pro.
Yeah, they're good. I'm trying to think what else. I've used kind of like a boulder. Well, it wasn't really a boulder, it was more like a kind of a lip of rock that I was sitting on, and I put the rope around that, and like, if you know, and then my
Ryan, be quiet. Sorry, what was that?
So I was climbing.
He hears you talking and he's like, me too.
Whose idea was it to start a podcast after having a newborn?
Sorry, Nate. You're gonna have a lot of editing work on this one, Nate. I'm really sorry.
Please leave
it's because we take turns talking. I'll say something and then he says something throughout the day, so he can't hear you as clearly. So when I stop talking, he feels like he should answer.
So, yeah, so I was climbing, did a lead climb. It was probably, we're talking very difficult, HVD at the best, because I'm not that great. So, and I'm not that bold. And I like having picnics while I'm climbing. So I get to the top, I set up an anchor, and it's made up of two pieces of gear. So there's a crack in the rock that I'm sitting on, and that's got like a nut in it. So I put that in. That's my solid piece, which is most... That's kind of what I'm betting the anchor is going to be on. The next one was like wrapping a rope around also what I was sitting on. But it was... My second gets to the top, and he looks at it and just goes, well, I'm glad I didn't fall, because that is the... worst anchor that I've ever seen. And it's like, and I've heard of people using like tufts of like a sturdy looking tuft of grass before, like just wrapping the rope, sling around it, and being like, yeah, that'll count. It's like in a multi-point anchor, that will give me something.
Wow,
I'll take the pressure off.
Mm. No,
heard of. Most of the time, it's like you'll find a good boulder that you can put a sling around. You'll also find some cracks which you can put some nuts in, and you just got to make it up from, you know, minimum 2 points, but you're kind of wanting three in there. And there's a numbering system on how you grade pieces, and I'm sorry for any pro trad climbers out there on how I'm misrepresenting this wonderful sport really well, because I can't remember what it is, but you want to score, you know, each piece of gear you'd have a score related to it.
If I remember correctly, I think it's that the you want a score of 12, I think it is, isn't it? And a really solid piece counts as a 4. Kind of a medium piece counts as a 3. And like a not very good piece, but will probably do something, counts as a 2.
Yeah.
Moving on slightly from, I guess, from... bolting and gear anchors and that, there's a couple of other things that I kind of want to discuss a little bit in terms of differences between North America and the UK. And one of them is, we've got this term dirt bag in both places. Steve, start with you. What does dirt bag, what would a UK dirt bag be? Talk about the car that they might have, what their diet might consist of, and then we'll go to Monica.
Yeah, a dirtbag climber is someone who everything they do is to make sure they can buy nice gear.
Yeah.
Because gear is expensive. Like, you could be talking, people can spend easily £1,000 on a rack made of active protection. So it's expensive. So the kind of job they'll work in an outdoor gear shop. They'll be working there, saving up money to go on their next climbing trip. That's the whole point of their life. the car you're going to be driving as a climber is going to be Renault Clio. Is a very typical climbing
so
car.
Like just a small two-door hatchback.
Yep. oh yeah, tiny.
If you were to try to sleep in, you would have your feet out the window if you were taller than about 5'4".
Yeah, pretty much. Yeah. So it's tiny, but it's a hatchback so that you can sort your gear out on the back. You know, you, the seats are always folded down.
Yeah.
There's always going to be rope in there, but it's kind of, you know.
A mysterious white powder just all through the boot of the car.
Yeah, everything is covered in chalk. There is no way to get around that. Like, diet is going to mostly consist of, like, instant noodles, yeah, anything cheap, really, just to make sure that when you go climbing, all of your time is going to be spent attempting that E1 that you've got your eye on for a little while. So you're going to get to the top, you're going to have your instant noodles, you're going to have your baked beans. It's going to be, that's what I think of that as like a dirt bag. And the car barely runs as well. Mm. Like, the worse it runs, the better climber you are.
And what beer are they going to be drinking?
Oh, beer. It's going to be... All right, so this is where I think the only thing they'd spend money on is going to be some fancy beer from like a brewery in Sheffield. So that's what we're going to be having for that. Like, it's a little craft brewery there. Or it's going to be like Carling, like, which is the cheapest, nastiest lager you can get.
I bet you could probably convince a Canadian that it's like high quality import, but yeah, as far as Brits are concerned, Carling lager is not.
I feel like cheap British beer has an edge on cheap North American beer.
I don't want to diss Carling too much, but while we're here, it's like, it's on, I'd say it's on par with like store brand cheapest value budget lager.
Mate, Carlings are our sponsor. I love it.
Other beers are available.
Oh, I'm joking. Dear.
All right, so how does that compare, Monica? What would a dirtbag in Canada be like? What, start with a car.
I mean, it's not that different.
No,
the car
not.
Will probably be twice the size, at least, if not a van.
Yeah.
I feel like that's more the vehicle of choice. I feel like they don't have cars that small. but also, a lot of the roads are more challenging to get up, so I feel like people have bigger vehicles just to make it to the Craigs. Everything in the UK is paved.
Yeah.
Like you, it's impossible to be in the middle of nowhere. Like everything, you can drive along the Peak District. You can drive on the bottom shelf, on the top shelf. You can probably see a village no matter where you are. Like it's no such thing as wilderness. Where I think people, dirtbags, need to have a bit more of the essentials with them in the car. A lot of people sleep in their car or van. That's pretty normal. I mean, food-wise, yeah, I think.
Instant
can of beans.
Noodles.
I've seen Ziploc bags of rice and nothing else.
Mm.
Yeah, that's. I feel like beer is a currency among dirtbag climbers.
Absolutely.
I think, oh, you know, bum a ride off you for a beer, done. I'll be your 100%. Belay partner for a beer, done. It's just that's the currency, probably because nobody actually has money.
Have you ever seen that photo, Steve? I know you've seen this. There's the ultimate Canadian dirtbag. Oh, no, sorry, he's American, isn't he? American dirtbag named Fred Becky. There's a documentary about him, but there's this famous photo of him. If you search Fred Becky climbing for food, there's just this photo of him as like a... looks like he's about 70 years old, on the side of the road with covered in all his climbing gear with a sign that says "Will belay for food."
I've got it.
Yeah, that's pretty classic. Yeah, other than that, I feel like maybe people in BC might smoke a bit more pot than they do out here. That might kind of come with the climbing dirtbag territory. That's maybe a bit more foreign to Brits.
No, I think that's pretty like you definitely get a nice stench.
A waft.
The crag. You've got to bring plenty of snacks just because you get the munchies when you go
climbing. Well, there you go. Maybe it's not so different after all. I don't know. What would you say, Nate? Do you think there's any other stark differences?
No. I think we got it. I love me some Kokanee in Canada.
Mm.
Or if you're going really budget, go for some Hell's Gate Lager.
Hell's Gate Lager.
It's great.
I'm not sure if I've ever stooped so low.
Oh. Quality. I think it's like 50% water. What am I saying? Beer is pretty much exclusively water. And then a bit of yeast.
It's watered down cheap lager.
Yeah.
What are we talking here? Describe it to me.
It is not good. It tastes a little bit metallic. It is very weak. And yeah.
I think these boys are forgetting that it's not a beer podcast.
No, I'm very sorry. Right, last... Last
back to the climbing podcast.
Well, this is my last thing that I wanted to know about. So this is the post-climb routine. So you've had a good day out. What is the first place that you would go after a good day out of climbing, Steve?
It's the pub.
The pub.
Yeah.
For some fish and chips and a beer.
In fact, yeah, exactly. Like there's sometimes you'll go climbing and the weather will be so bad. And you're just like a good climbing day will be spent in a pub talking about how much you dislike boulderers or how much you dislike sport climbers. Like, you'll just be there, like, there'll be all these grizzled men around and women, but with trad climbers, it's hard to tell the difference sometimes.
Because the men have too much hair.
And that's, everyone will be grizzled and sort of drinking a real ale at this point, you know, and it's like they've got their huge pint glass and he's kind of going talking about some boulder with his child-sized bouldering shoes and a t-shirt that isn't really worn at all. It's just thrown off at the first instance. And
yeah.
How that's nothing compared to your goose down jacket that protects you from the rain and other kind of elements when you're climbing in your massive boots in some scree-covered slope that's referred to as a crag in a guidebook. That's kind of like British climbing.
There you go. Yeah, but pub is the go-to place. Complain about someone. Yeah.
I was going to say, okay, we finished a day in Squamish. What do you do?
You go to Mags 99.
Yeah, you do.
So that's very, very specific. So I would say that you typically would end up at the cheapest fast food joint that you can find that would give you, not necessarily the cheapest, but the maximum value for money.
Yes.
So most this calories, is why if you're in Squamish, yeah, exactly. Most calories, least amount of dollars. If you're in Squamish, you will end up at Mags 99, which is a Mexican chicken place, kind of.
You're going to get a burrito, though.
Yeah, you're going to get a burrito. Or if you're feeling really flush, a chimichanga.
Mm.
And then the fallback is always McDonald's.
Yeah. Sad.
But
there you go. Then it's back on the Sea to Sky Highway and heading
back
for home.
Yeah.
With the sunset setting behind you.
So those are, I think there's more to it than that, but those are kind of the biggest ones that we could think of in the 5 minutes that we spent preparing this podcast.
Well, we kind of focused on climbing, didn't we?
I think we talked
about mountaineering and other aspects of outdoorsmanship, but don't have time. Steve talks too much.
I do talk way too much.
So I think just the last thing that I want to say, just as a call out to you as the listener, if you enjoyed this and there are other things that you think are differences between climbers in North America and the UK, or if there's things that you feel like are very stereotypical about climbing in either the North America or the UK that we did not mention, please get in touch with us and let us know. We'd love to hear from you. We always do enjoy it. You can email us at picnicclimbers@gmail.com. or follow us on Instagram at Picnic Climbers. We would love to hear from you.
Yeah, and secondly, if you think that you have an interesting topic that you'd like to share and you want to be featured on our podcast and live up to our very first guest, Mr. Stephen Miller, then let us know and we can chat.
Brilliant. So, Steve, thank you so much for coming on the podcast. It was great to chat to you today. I think your wisdom and your stories are very much appreciated.
Thank you for having me witter on for about an hour.
it's the best way to spend a Friday night in lockdown.
Chatting with your friends about the good old days when you could leave the house and go climbing.
Mm. The good old days of 2 years ago.
Yeah. All right. We'll climb soon, Steve. And to all our listeners, thank you for listening and bye for now.
Bye for now. Thanks so much for joining us today.
If you enjoyed listening along, be sure to subscribe and leave a comment on iTunes.
If you want to get in touch, follow us on Instagram at Picnic Climbers or email us at picnicclimbers@gmail.com.
Until next time, Picnic Climbers.